content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 21st, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a city street scene. Looks like it's probably in Gaza. Bombed out buildings on either side, a destroyed car, rubble all over the place. In the foreground is Benjamin Netanyahu. In his right hand, he's holding a bird cage. There's a white dove with a olive branch in its beak. On his left hand, he's got a falconer's glove and a huge, fierce-looking hawk sitting on top. He's looking at it, and it's looking at him. The headline is, Hawks in Charge. What's stopping Netanyahu and Hamas from reaching a ceasefire deal? That is our first main story. We'll start there. Israel rescues hostages as political turmoil rises. Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz resigned this week from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet and called for new elections, delivering a blow to the embattled prime minister as the country celebrated the rescue of four hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. The captives, all abducted from a music festival in the Israeli desert on October 7th, were freed in meticulously planned simultaneous daytime raids on two apartment buildings in the crowded Nusayrat refugee camp. Israeli special forces took the Hamas militants holding one hostage, Noah Argamani, by surprise, but a gun battle erupted as they entered the second building. The commandos got all the hostages into vehicles, and the Israeli Air Force launched dozens of strikes to give the soldiers cover. Israel rejoiced as the hostages were reunited with their families, but the raids sparked international criticism as footage of charred bodies and bloodied children circulated. Gazan health officials said at least 274 Palestinians were killed in the raid. An Israeli Defense Forces spokesman said the death toll was under 100, including Hamas fighters. One Israeli soldier was killed in the operation. Gantz announced his resignation after warning for weeks that he would leave the cabinet in early June if Netanyahu failed to offer a credible plan to bring home the remaining 100-plus hostages and establish an alternative government in the Palestinian enclave. Netanyahu prevents us from moving forward to a real victory, he said in a televised statement. Gantz joined the cabinet in a show of unity after October 7th, but has accused Netanyahu, whose ruling coalition relies on the support of far-right allies, of following the path of zealots. Netanyahu said the war would continue until Israel has secured the release of all our hostages and the elimination of Hamas. International pressure for a ceasefire grew, with the UN Security Council endorsing a U.S.-backed proposal and Secretary of State Antony Blinken making his eighth trip to the region. But a deal remained stalled. Netanyahu has disputed aspects of the U.S. plan, and Hamas made new demands that Blinken called unacceptable. Blinken vowed to push on, but acknowledged that the militants' rejection of a deal very similar to one they'd previously agreed to raises questions about whether they're proceeding in good faith or not. What the editorial said. The daring hostage rescue was a ray of light amid the darkness and should have prompted global celebrations at the New York Post. But it seems Israel can't even rescue innocents without Hamas cheerleaders and useful idiots in the West erupting in outrage. They were incensed that Israel dared to rescue its citizens from monstrous Islamist killers because Palestinians died in the process. But those deaths must be pinned squarely on Hamas, which hides hostages among civilians, precisely to ensure this outcome. The hostages' return to their loved ones is reason to rejoice, said the Washington Post. But Gaza remains awash in immense human suffering that must be relieved. The six-week truce proposed by the Biden administration would enable a surge of humanitarian aid and an initial exchange of some Hamas hostages for hundreds of Palestinian militants and Israeli prisons in Israeli prisons. But Hamas negotiators reportedly insist on a permanent ceasefire and total Israeli withdrawal that Netanyahu simply won't accept. As Blinken continues his long-shot negotiation, we wish him luck. What the columnist said: the dramatic hostage rescue was months in the making and involved thousands of troops, technicians, and analysts, said Steve Hendricks in the Washington Post. Israeli intelligence units with U.S. assistance studied digital clues, drone footage, and intercepts to locate the hostages. Israelis constructed facsimiles of the buildings they were housed in, where troops spent weeks drilling amid tight secrecy. Choosing to run the operation in daylight for peak surprise was a considerable risk, but the gamble paid off. Coming a day later, Gantz's move made news around the world, said Yair Rosenberg in The Atlantic. With Netanyahu's coalition maintaining a majority in the Israeli parliament, his departure is not a governmental death blow, but it is still meaningful. The popular centrist moderate voice is gone, and Netanyahu is even more beholden to the hardliners in his coalition. They're dead set on ending ceasefire talks and humanitarian assistance to Gaza and fighting Hamas to the bitter end. Netanyahu is in a bind, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. His hard right allies oppose the only feasible scenario for a post-war Gaza not dominated by Hamas, installing some kind of Palestinian government. Instead, they want Netanyahu to announce plans to reoccupy and settle Gaza. But such a move would incite a rebellion within his Likud party. So far, Netanyahu's survival solution has been to string out a deadly and strategically dubious war, a strategy that's likely to continue. Hamas military leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, is also in no rush to end the conflict, said Summer Sayed and Rory Jones in the Wall Street Journal. For months, he's resisted pressure to cut a ceasefire deal, and messages he's sent Hamas mediators that we've obtained show that behind his reticence is the calculation that more fighting and more Palestinian civilian deaths work to his advantage. The dead women and children are necessary sacrifices in a war with an enemy he has vowed to eliminate. With international outrage growing over the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, he wrote, "We had the Israelis right where we want them." And we'll read the second main story this week. Hunter Biden convicted after wrenching testimony. What happened? Hunter Biden, the first child of a U.S. president to face a criminal trial, was found guilty on three federal gun charges this week in a case that became a flashpoint of debate about the independence of the justice system. The Delaware jury took just 3 hours to render its verdict, a reflection of the strength of the prosecution's case. Some of the most damaging witnesses were members of Biden's family, including his ex-wife, Kathleen Buhl, and his brother Beau's widow, Halle Biden, both testifying for the prosecution. His daughter, Naomi Biden, testified in his defense. All three described the pain they suffered as Biden struggled with his addiction to crack cocaine. The jury heard that he introduced Halle, whom he dated after Beau died, to crack, and she, too, became addicted. "It was a terrible experience that I went through," Halle said, "and I'm embarrassed and ashamed." The testimonies largely supported prosecutors' assertions that Biden was still in the throes of addiction when he purchased a gun and affirmed on a federal form that he was not a drug user. "Jill and I love our son, and we are so proud of the man he is today," President Biden said after the verdict. He also reiterated that he would respect the judicial process and would not consider a pardon. The judge in the case, Mary Ellen Noriega, had rejected an earlier plea deal, and Hunter Biden could face up to 25 years in prison. But his gun was not used in a crime, and nonviolent first-time offenders are rarely imprisoned on such charges. Biden is also slated to stand trial in September on three more felony charges in California, this time for tax evasion. What the editorial said. The verdict undermines the claim by the recently convicted Donald Trump that the justice system is rigged against him, said the Washington Post. No one is above the law, not even the president's son. But Hunter could have spared his family this distressing spectacle by accepting an ordinary plea rather than insisting on one with wider immunity, which Noriega rightly tore up. In his next trial, he should think less about his own interest and more about what's best for his father's reelection hopes and the country. The jury called it correctly, but there was plenty of favoritism on tap, said National Review. Biden avoided prosecution for almost 5 years and nearly ran out the statute of limitations. And the trial didn't even touch on the real scandal that he traded his father's political influence for big paydays from agents of corrupt and anti-American regimes. It was just a sordid tale of a man who squandered his advantages to become a wrecking ball of arrogance, substance abuse, betrayal of his duties to his children. What the columnist said. President Biden's detractors paint him as feeble, but he was strong enough and tough enough to choose upholding the law, said Jill Lawrence in the Bulwark. Throughout the investigation, indictment, trial, and verdict, he did not call the system rigged. He did not howl about the unfairness of it all. Unlike Trump, Joe Biden has faith in our system. Trump and his extremist base seem disappointed by the outcome, as if they were secretly hoping Hunter would get off, said Greg Sargent in the New Republic. Yet they're still trying to spin the verdict as proof of Biden administration malfeasance. Trump called the verdict a distraction from the real crimes of the Biden crime family, while MAGA activist Charlie Kirk said the case was a fake trial trying to make the justice system appear balanced. Now that they're both felons, I have decided that I am not voting for Donald Trump or Hunter Biden, said Alyssa Farah Griffin in the Daily Beast. Oh, wait, Hunter is not on the ballot. The reality is that both convictions help President Biden. More than half of independents think Trump's conviction means he should leave the race. And in the wake of Hunter's conviction, President Biden emerges looking like a caring father who respects the Constitution. Countless Americans know what it's like when an addict goes off the rails. How many can relate to someone paying a large sum of hush money to hide an alleged affair with an adult film star? Controversy of the week. Payback. Will Trump seek revenge for his conviction? The idea of jailing one's enemies is hardly a new concept for Donald Trump, said Jonathan Swan in the New York Times. In his 2016 presidential campaign, he echoed an encouraged chant of lock her up against his opponent, Hillary Clinton. And since his felony conviction in New York last month, Trump has talked about retribution with a new fervor. I would have every right to go after them, he told Fox News' Sean Hannity last week, referring to President Biden, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, and unspecified other Democratic tormentors. What's new is that Republicans of all stripes are now echoing Trump's call for legal payback and not cloaking their intent with euphemisms. Former Trump advisor Stephen Miller called on every Republican DA and elected official to launch investigations and gin up charges to beat these communists. Even the usually measured Senator Marco Rubio, a possible Trump VP pick, posted on X that Republicans must fight fire with fire. Aggressive bluster has always been part of Trump's shtick, said Dan McLaughlin in the New York Post. But he did not lock up Clinton, and he was explicit that while he's aggrieved, justifiably, about his conviction in the New York business records case, his only revenge will be success. Republicans may genuinely want payback, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post, but exacting legal retribution is easier said than done. Consider what happened when Trump's Attorney General, William Barr, appointed a special counsel, John Durham, to probe Russiagate, the supposed deep state plot to frame Trump as a Kremlin agent. After a four-year investigation, Durham produced nothing. House Republicans have also spent years trying and failing to organize a revenge impeachment of Biden. At this point, the GOP is more successful at sound and fury than specifics. If Trump cares about the country, he should seek retribution, said John Yoo in National Review. It used to be a sacred Democratic norm that we didn't use the legal system to pursue departing presidents. George W. Bush, for example, didn't prosecute Bill Clinton for lying to the Whitewater Special Counsel. Democrats have shredded that precedent by bringing a series of deeply flawed cases against Trump to kneecap his bid for a second term. In so doing, they crossed constitutional Rubicon, potentially starting an escalating cycle of tit-for-tat presidential prosecutions. Paradoxically, the only way to restore the rule of law may be for Republicans to retaliate in kind with political prosecutions of Democrats from Biden on down. Alternatively, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, they could nominate someone who isn't a career criminal. Trump's legal troubles are indeed unprecedented, but that's because we never before elected a president who paid off porn stars, willfully absconded with nuclear secrets, or tried to stay in office despite losing an election. There will be political prosecutions if Trump wins in November, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. Project 2025, a second-term blueprint drawn up by MAGA allies, details plans to weaponize the Justice Department against Democrats and blue America generally. But retribution is merely this week's pretext. Republicans' ultimate goal is to roll back the political and cultural settlements of the past half century and return power to the people, specifically a narrow, exclusive people defined in racial, religious, and ideological terms, embodied in the person of one Donald J. Trump. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for hard decisions. After Donald Trump informed supporters at Las Vegas rally that if given the choice between being eaten by a shark or electrocuted by the battery of an electric-powered boat, he, Trump, will take electrocution every single time. It was a good week for the next rider. After Bike Share Toronto asked users participating in the city's annual World Naked Bike Ride to please wipe down the seats and handlebars after their ride so that they are sanitized for the next rider. It was a good week for Max the Cat. A frequent and beloved visitor to Vermont State University's Castleton campus, which has now awarded the 5-year-old tabby with the prestigious title of Doctor of Literature, together with his own university email address. But it was a bad week for photobombing. After developers in Tokyo agreed to demolish a new 10-story apartment building because locals complained it spoiled their view of Japan's iconic Mount Fuji. We were aware of the local culture that values scenery, said a spokesman for Sekusi House Limited, but we failed to consider it adequately. It was a bad week for thespians. After England's Royal Shakespeare company placed a trigger warning on its new production of The Merry Wives of Windsor, cautioning audiences that the fat knight Sir John Falstaff is subjected to body shaming in the 1602 play. Finally, it was a bad week for fun. After police in Finland began blasting Vivaldi's Four Seasons to deter youths from partying on local beaches, young people stay away from places where there is classical music, said an officer. The title of the briefing this week is The Great Baby Bust. The fertility rate is falling sharply in the U.S. and elsewhere, a trend with major economic and societal consequences. Where are birth rates dropping? Almost everywhere. Two-thirds of the world's population now lives in countries where the birth rate has dropped below 2.1 babies per woman, the number needed to keep the population constant. Experts estimate that the global fertility rate has already or will soon drop below this so-called replacement rate. In the U.S., the birth rate stands at 1.62, down from 2.12 in 2007, and the population is expected to dip after peaking at 370 million in 2080. In Europe, the average birth rate is now 1.5, in East Asia, 1.2, in Latin America, 1.9. This trend has surprised demographers, many of whom have spent years worrying about an overcrowded planet. As recently as 2017, the UN was predicting that the world's population, about 8 billion today, would climb to 11 billion by 2100. But researchers at the University of Washington now expect the population to peak at about 9.5 billion in 2061 and then start falling. That would be the first such global population decline since the Black Death in the Middle Ages. The demographic winter is coming, said Jesus Fernandez Villaverde, a University of Pennsylvania economist. Why are experts worried? Because a shrinking population means that more jobs will go unfilled, economic growth will slow, and programs like Social Security, which rely on the working age to pay in and support the growing ranks of the elderly, will be underfunded. Today, the world's richest economies have roughly three people of working age for everyone over 65. But by 2050, they will have fewer than two. The results of this shift can be seen in South Korea, which has the world's lowest fertility rate at 0.72, and where the national pension program is expected to run out of cash by 2055. Economic dynamism could also take a hit as populations get smaller and grayer. More people means more potential for innovation and growth. Economists say it's no coincidence that the world's population, wealth, and standards of living have all soared in the 250 years since the Industrial Revolution. Research shows that patents filed by younger inventors are more likely to cover breakthrough innovations, and that younger electorates are more likely to support pro-growth policies, especially home building. What's behind the drop? In the U.S., experts initially pointed the finger at economic insecurity, noting that the birth rate began falling after the 2008 financial crisis. But research published in 2021 found that almost none of the fertility rate decline could be explained by state-level differences in unemployment, contraceptive usage, student debt, housing, or child care cost, or numerous other factors. Instead, study co-author Melissa Kearney, an economist at the University of Maryland, suspects that both men and women are choosing to prioritize career development, leisure, and relationships outside the home, all of which are more likely to come in conflict with childbearing. Similar trends could be playing out across developed and developing countries, with societies becoming increasingly tolerant of people who have fewer or no children. But a different set of factors is driving the demographic crisis in China, where the fertility rate is now about 1.2 children per woman, down from 6 in the 1960s, and where the population is shrinking. How fast is China's population declining? It dropped by 850,000 people to 1.41 billion in 2022, the first such fall since a deadly famine in 1961. The population dipped again last year by more than 2 million, largely a result of record low births. If current trends continue, the population could fall another 800 million by 2100. That drop is a result of the one-child policy imposed by the Communist Party in the 1970s to slow population growth. That policy not only reduced the reproductive age population, but also made the one-child family a cultural ideal, said Beijing-based journalist Helen Gao. Chinese authorities scrapped the policy in 2015, but the birth rate has not ticked up because grown-up single children who enjoyed their parents' undivided attention want their offspring to have a similar upbringing. Can birth rates be boosted? Governments are trying, but nothing has been particularly effective. Japan has experimented with child care subsidies and stipends since the 1990s. Its fertility rate climbed from 1.26 in 2005 to 1.45 in 2015, then sank to 1.26 again in 2022. South Korea has invested more than $270 billion in fertility initiatives since 2006, but its birth rate keeps declining. Developed countries could open their doors to immigrants from poorer nations with high fertility rates, such as those in sub-Saharan Africa. But many politicians who worry most loudly about their country's demographic decline are also nationalists who prize native-born babies over immigrants. "We want Hungarian children," said Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. "Migration for us is surrender." Are there other solutions? Because so many attempts to reverse this trend have failed, some experts argue governments should simply accept and plan for a world of smaller families and shrinking populations. Those who want more children should be supported accordingly, argues Sarah Harper, a professor of gerontology at Oxford University. But officials should also focus on how smaller populations could ease pressure on housing and land, and potentially slow climate change. "We live on a finite planet," Harper said, "and falling populations, while novel historically, have many advantages for the 21st century." Moving into the best columns of the week. I actually think we'll take all three from the U.S. this week. First up, why limits on asylum are needed. The U.S. simply can't absorb everyone from other countries who'd prefer to live here, said Nicholas Kristof, which is why President Biden made the right call in curbing access to asylum. Immigration activists and some fellow Democrats were chagrined by Biden's executive order last week to put strict limits and rules on asylum claims, viewing it as a continuation of Donald Trump's cruel crackdown. But the system wasn't working. There have been thousands of illegal border crossings every day, and asylum claims now take years to resolve. Immigration should be seen as a dial that we adjust rather than a door that's either closed, shut, or wide open. Immigrants reduce costs for employers and benefit the economy overall, but they also put downward wage pressure on jobs for Americans without college degrees. Unfortunately, Republican lawmakers are blocking comprehensive immigration reform, so Biden needed to act for valid political reasons. One way or another, an angry public will force change on immigration. Choose one: stricter limits on immigration, or Trump's promise to shut the border, lock up more than 10 million immigrants in mass detention camps, and conduct the largest deportation in American history. A handgun, no, but a nuke, yes. As a convicted felon, Donald Trump will soon lose his license to carry a concealed handgun in New York City, said Matt Lewis. Yet the same man who is considered too dangerous to own a pistol is one election victory away from being put in charge of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. It's a stark reminder of how absurd our country has become in the Trump era. In many states, convicted felons are not eligible to vote, yet millions of Americans will cast their presidential ballots for a convicted felon. He's eligible to run because America's founders never imagined that someone like Trump would get within 10 miles of the presidency. Trump has been charged with stealing a huge trove of classified documents and intelligence secrets, but if he wins the election, he will once again be given carte blanche authority to view or declassify any document he sees fit. Admired by followers as a great businessman, Trump has been fined $355 million and barred from doing business in New York for 3 years for vastly inflating the value of his properties to banks and insurers. I could go on. Suffice it to say that Trump's lawless behavior has cost him nearly everything except his political mojo. Gambling's impact on baseball. Now that Major League Baseball has partnered with legal gambling companies to encourage betting on its games, said Bob Nightingale, the players are starting to fear for their safety. If players disappoint fans who wager on gambling apps from their phones both at home and at the stadium, they are abused and derided and barraged with death threats. So much money rides on every play that fans are yelling at players to amass a certain number of strikeouts or hits. It gets really ugly quickly, said Arizona Diamondbacks pitcher Paul Sewald. It's such a slippery slope because it's an addiction that people cannot stop. Even after the game, irate bettors continue to harass players with insults and threats via social media. San Francisco Giants relief pitcher Tyler Rogers says that if he blows a save, fans are sending him Venmo requests and the message, "Hey, you cost me $1,500. You better pay me back." Players are succumbing to gambling's allure, too, with former Pittsburgh Pirates infielder Tucupita Marcano recently banned for life for betting more than $150,000 on games. The integrity of baseball itself is being damaged, but who needs integrity when there's a revenue stream pouring oceans of gambling money into the game? The last word, our in-depth article, a shelter under siege. For decades, Ruben Garcia has welcomed migrants and refugees at Annunciation House, said Arelis R. Hernandez in the Washington Post. Now Texas wants to shut down the Catholic nonprofit. El Paso. Wilson Alexander Juarez Hernandez crossed the border on a stretcher. He could not speak or walk. He'd lost so much weight that his fragile skeletal frame jutted out from his skin. His legs and hands were twisted and locked defensively into a fetal position. For 3 months, he'd languished in a hospital bed in the border city of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, a ventilator pushing oxygen in and out of his weakened lungs. 40 people had died during the fire at an overcrowded Mexican detention center for migrants last spring. He survived, but now he faced a long recovery and the possibility of never walking again. The United States agreed to grant him humanitarian parole so that he could enter the country and be treated by specialists in Texas. But he'd need ongoing therapeutic care, the kind that is hard for many Americans to get, let alone an immigrant. Who might take him in? "How could I say no?" recounted Ruben Garcia, looking at Wilson, who sat in a wheelchair before him. There was no one else. The influential patriarch of Annunciation House, a faith-based network of shelters based in El Paso, Garcia has taken in tens of thousands of undocumented immigrants he calls guests for nearly 5 decades. Working in collaboration with U.S. immigration officials, he provides them food, clothes, and a first home in the U.S., and some of his expenses are reimbursed by the federal government. It's work he sees as a religious calling to help the most vulnerable, no matter how they arrived. But as Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott clamps down on illegal immigration, state investigators are raising questions about Garcia's humanitarian work. In court records, they contend that his shelters are stash houses, sheltering the undocumented from authorities. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is asking a judge to shut down Garcia's Annunciation House shelters and force him to turn over all of his organization's records, including the names of people he is housing. Garcia has refused, setting up a legal battle between the state of Texas and a religious leader whose work is key to the federal government's management of border crossings and who has drawn praise from the highest echelons of the Catholic Church. The case is tied to a bill passed in 2015 that makes it a state crime to encourage or induce someone to enter the country illegally by concealing, harboring, or shielding them from detection. The legislation was approved shortly after Abbott became governor and marked the first in a string of bills he has backed challenging federal authority on immigration. Garcia has not been charged, but Paxton's office is using the organization's refusal to turn over internal documents he demanded as a reason to shut it down. The probe, which Pope Francis has denounced as madness, has saddened and angered Garcia, 75. He wonders why the state is targeting him now, when he has been doing the same work for most of his adult life. He tried but failed to contain his emotions as he led a group of college students from Massachusetts on a tour of one of his shelters on a recent afternoon. "The Attorney General of my state has the audacity to refer to what is holy ground as a stash house," he said, his voice quavering as it echoed inside an old chapel. "I'm asking you, is that what you see?" Hundreds of migrants needed his help that March day. There was the Guatemalan woman beaten so badly that local police initially thought she was dead. The Colombian family who left their crime-ridden hometown and now, after crossing the border, had nowhere to go. The 25-year-old mother who learned she had cancer after crossing 9 countries to reach the border with her 3-year-old daughter. And then there was Wilson. He recently celebrated his 22nd birthday by taking several labored steps on his own with a walker around the shelter's cafeteria. He couldn't feed himself, dress himself, or say what hurt weeks earlier, but now he was preparing to deliver a speech that night for a vigil marking a year since the blaze. Stringing together full sentences was still tough, but little by little, his voice was starting to return. He'd uttered each word as if he'd just run a mile to spurt it out. Make a wish, Wilson, the other shelter residents yelled as he leaned over a chocolate cake. He nodded, signaling he had made one, and flashed a worried glance over at Garcia, the man who had become his keeper and protector, before he blew the candles out. Garcia is a native son of El Paso. The border has defined his life, not as a line dividing two nations, but as a suture uniting a region otherwise ripped apart by war, poverty, and violence. As a young adult, he led youth programs for the Catholic Diocese of El Paso, but he was restless. He wanted to live a life of purpose, and he was struggling to figure out how. He found the answer in Segundo Barrio, one of the city's oldest and poorest neighborhoods. In his 20s, he moved into the vacant top floor of a church building, there with a small group of other idealistic young Catholics. Together, they set off on a mission to help the neediest. One day, Garcia came across a homeless man. He pointed him to two shelters run by the city in hopes of helping him find a place to stay. But the man soon returned. He'd been turned away, porque no tengo papeles. He didn't have papers. The diocese donated the church building to Garcia and his colleagues in 1978. Some of the earliest guests were Nicaraguan officials with the Somoza dictatorship who had been detained after fleeing the 1979 Sandinista Revolution. Federal officials asked Garcia to house them temporarily, he recalled, a decision for which he was criticized because of the regime's repression of its people, but he saw them simply as people in need. The Salvadoran priest, Archbishop Oscar Romero, is one of the inspirations behind Garcia's work. Romero was shot to death in 1980 while celebrating Mass during his country's civil war. Garcia, who shares more than a passing bespeckled resemblance to Romero, welcomed thousands fleeing the violence to his border shelter. He also later adopted and raised six children from El Salvador who were orphaned during the conflict. Garcia long insisted on a separation between the work of the nonprofit and that of immigration authorities. But as the number of people arriving at the border has risen, the work of both agencies has become more closely intertwined. In the past, most of those crossing the border were Mexican men. By 2014, that demographic changed radically. Children and families from all over the world began surrendering to authorities and requesting asylum. By law, families with children cannot be detained for long periods. Officials soon realized they'd need help, and so they called Garcia. Annunciation House expanded its operations and recruited more volunteers. Looking back, longtime volunteers said that moment felt quaint compared with what happened in 2022 when the migration numbers exploded again. The organization went from providing shelter to several hundred people at a time to having to find housing for up to 10,000 per day. Garcia pulled in other houses of worship and nonprofits to help. Donors helped him book blocks of hotel rooms. People donated blankets and foods. Every day, federal law enforcement officials let Garcia know how many people they planned to release in hopes that he'd offer them shelter. However, scrutiny of border nonprofits has been building in right-wing circles since President Biden entered office and began undoing some of former President Donald Trump's immigration policies. The Biden administration leaned heavily on faith-based groups such as Catholic Charities as crossings rose sharply. The federal government reimbursed their costs to temporarily shelter and feed migrants. That rankled congressional Republicans. House Judiciary Committee members demanded the email communications between the administration and nonprofits. Conservative Catholic groups have also accused some charities of exceeding their religious calling and creating a welfare state for migrants. Representative Lance Gooden, Republican from Texas, introduced legislation to defund nonprofits that are complicit in human smuggling and exacerbating the crisis at our southern border. Not long after Gooden first raised the issue, Abbott, the Texas governor, called on Paxton to investigate border nonprofits. A former FBI agent, a longtime homicide detective, a lawyer, and a researcher with Paxton's office all spent days scoping out Annunciation House, according to court documents. One noted how Garcia delivered groceries in his beat-up white Toyota pickup. Another watched several Hispanic individuals coming in and out of the shelter, according to court records. Prosecutors said one investigator saw laundry hanging on a clothesline, indicating to them that people were living at the shelter. They pointed to a 2023 news article about Annunciation House's legal workshops for asylum seekers as the basis of their inquiry. On February 7, 2023, the Wednesday before Lent began, prosecutors served the Catholic nonprofit with a demand to examine everything Annunciation House leaders had. The Attorney General's office's subpoena gave them 24 hours to produce everything, Garcia said, including hard drives and documents dating back a half century. For now, the subpoena has been blocked by a court, but Mark P. Jones, a political scientist at Rice University who has spent years studying Paxton, said what the Attorney General ultimately cares about is sending a message to Republican primary voters. He's already achieved what he wants to achieve, Jones said. His goal is to gain the publicity for going after Annunciation House and also putting pressure on it and other nonprofits to be more cautious. At 21, Wilson decided his future lay north. He and his father left their home in Guatemala and journeyed to the U.S.-Mexico border. But before they could cross, Mexican authorities apprehended Wilson. Under pressure from the U.S. government, Mexican officials had been cracking down on illegal immigration. Law enforcement conducted sweeps at bus and train stations, placing men and women in overcrowded detention facilities. Then came the fire. For at least 13 minutes, Wilson was trapped in a cell as flames darted around him. According to the Mexican government, inmates had set the fire in protest. The detainees kicked the bars and screamed for help. Immigration officials had the keys to the cells, but did not free the detainees. By the time firefighters broke into the building, Wilson was nearly dead. He arrived in the United States months later, disfigured and disabled. Little by little, he learned how to move his toes and fingers again. His stiffened limbs began to loosen. Another migrant bathed and fed him. The volunteers and newcomers at Annunciation House wanted to love him back to a version of himself he might recognize. Why would the state of Texas want to impede that? Garcia wondered aloud. I don't have a solution for the exit of people from their home country. But they're human beings, he said, sitting in the cafeteria of one of the shelters as migrant families ate lunch. And when we mistreat them, it's our humanity that's lost. The conflict with Texas leaders has had a chilling effect throughout the border region. Humanitarian and faith-based organizations regularly call Annunciation's legal team seeking guidance. But the support has also been overwhelming. On a recent evening, hundreds marched from El Paso's downtown plaza to Sacred Heart Church. When it was finally time to introduce Wilson, Garcia rose and walked to the lectern. Cheers broke out. The assembly stood, and then silence enveloped the sanctuary. Garcia rolled Wilson's wheelchair toward the lectern. He gently wrapped his arms under Wilson's armpits and lifted him from the chair. Wilson looked out at the crowd, and his eyes grew red and watered as he struggled to form his lips around words and push out sound. The words were soft and muffled, but they bounced off the church's walls with the help of a microphone. Garcia kept him anchored, steadying his shoulders with his hands. Many of my friends did not have the opportunity to survive, Wilson said. Immigrants need support. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. And looks as though we've got time for just one of the talking points articles today. We'll do Manhattan car tolls, slamming on the brakes. New York City was just weeks away from reinventing itself for the 21st century, said Justin Davidson in New York Magazine. But Governor Kathy Hochul last week ordered a screeching U-turn into the distant past. At the last minute, Hochul got cold feet and put an indefinite pause on a controversial congestion pricing plan that would have imposed a $15 toll on vehicles entering the traffic-clogged heart of Manhattan, starting on June 30th. The toll, proposed by Mayor Mike Bloomberg in 2007 and approved by the state legislature in 2019, would have made Midtown streets safer, less polluted, and more pleasant for pedestrians and cyclists, and was projected to raise $1 billion annually to update the city's aging public transit infrastructure. Cities with similar congestion pricing plans, London, Singapore, Stockholm, have seen 20% drops in traffic, improved air quality, and fewer traffic deaths. But congestion pricing was highly unpopular among suburbanites and outer borough residents who prefer to drive into Manhattan to work, eat, or see theater. So Hochul and a few other politicians panicked. Sorry, but Americans do not much want to pay $15 to drive their cars anywhere, even in New York City, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch. Hochul explained her decision by saying the toll risks too many unintended consequences. No kidding. Don't all progressive big government projects have unintended consequences? Introducing an onerous new toll at this time would be lunacy, said Andrew Stuttiford in National Review. In Midtown Manhattan, post-COVID hybrid work schedules have devastated commercial real estate and the thousands of local businesses that cater to commuters. New York City needs to avoid doing anything that might discourage people from coming to work or play or shop in Manhattan. National politics also played a major role in Hochul's decision, said Nick Reisman in Politico. In the 2022 midterm elections, New York Republicans flipped four congressional seats in New York City's suburbs, races that helped give the GOP narrow control of the House. Democrats want to regain those seats in November, and polls show that 72% of suburban voters profoundly loathed congestion pricing. Republicans were pointing to the $15 toll as a cause célèbre of liberals out of touch with the working class. But Hochul's decision takes the issue off the table, at least for now. And a few of the short notes. More than 300 House members were reimbursed at least $5.8 million for food and lodging while on official business in Washington last year, under a new taxpayer-funded program that doesn't require them to provide receipts. Representative Jack Bergman, Republican from Michigan, was the program's top spender, getting reimbursed $32,000 for lodging and nearly $12,000 for meals. Israel last year commissioned a $2 million influence campaign targeting U.S. lawmakers and the public with pro-Israeli messaging to build support for its war in Gaza. The campaign created hundreds of accounts posing as real Americans on X, Facebook, and Instagram, and used AI to generate pro-Israeli posts, including many urging black and Democratic lawmakers to continue funding Israel's military. The invasive Joro spider, which has a 4-inch leg span, weaves 2-foot-wide webs and can float on the breeze using silken threads, is expected to establish itself in New York, New Jersey, and possibly southern Canada this summer. A native of East Asia that was first found in Georgia in 2013, the spider is harmless to humans, but does eat other invasive bug, the spotted lanternfly. On the poll watch, 73% of Americans under 65 years old are worried or extremely worried that Medicare will not be available by the time they are eligible to receive it, up from 67% 2 years ago. 80% have the same fear about Social Security. Among those aged 65 and above, 77% say they are more likely to support a candidate who makes a top priority of issues affecting older people. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from comedian Stephen Wright, quoted in Reader's Digest. I really like this one. He says, "If at first you don't succeed, then skydiving definitely is not for you." And with that, we have run out of time for today's program. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. It's 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.